All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about church history. And does everybody have a handout for that? So we've taken a little extra time here with announcements and prayer and just catching up on a few things, so we probably will not make it all the way through this. But what I want to do is talk about some of the things leading up to the Protestant Reformation. The characteristics of church and culture in the Catholic Church that made people really want change. So you see the primary heading there, the context of the Reformation, and the next heading is the continued corruption in the Catholic Church. So we've repeatedly commented on this corruption, the corruption of the popes and the church in general. So at one point leading up to the Reformation, there were three different popes at one time, so there's a lot of division in the church. They called councils. This was called the conciliar effort. They called councils to try to deal with these divisions and with these abuses within the church. However, they were compromised because they were made up of bishops, and the bishops themselves were a product of the corruption. So they were unwilling to deal with some of the buying and selling of church positions because they had bought their church positions and they were profiting from them. Queen Isabella in Spain at one point complained that the majority of the clergy were living in open concubinage. They had live-in girlfriends, in other words, and that any effort on the part of the civil authorities to bring the clergy to justice was met with resistance and sometimes armed resistance. So, you know, all the castles, what was a castle for? Right? A castle was for defense in these days. And the monasteries and the churches, they had some of their own defenses. And so these clergymen would defend themselves if the civil authorities tried to bring them to justice. So all of these corruptions finally led Christian people to mistrust the church. And here's a quote from the textbook that I've been using primarily, from Justo Gonzalez. How could the laity trust a sacrament of penance administered by a clergy that seemed to have no sense of the enormity of sin? So they are flagrant sinners themselves. They are not living a lifestyle of repentance. How could they trust a sacrament of penance that is administered by these kinds of priests? The religious conscience of Europe was divided within itself, torn between trust in a church that had been its spiritual mother for generations and the patent failures of the church. So, is it not true that this happens in church history where faithful believers will kind of look at the broader church, the more sort of popular church, the broader spectrum of the church, and they'll kind of scratch their head and say, not so sure about that, right? You know, so that happened at the turn of the last century. So around the 1900s, you had Protestant denominations becoming especially liberal. So it would have been kind of a result of German higher criticism and, you know, the questioning of all of the miracles in the Bible, the questioning of the inspiration of the Scriptures, the questioning of the virgin birth and the deity of Christ and all of these things, perhaps even questioning the resurrection itself. And so then faithful believers are kind of looking back at that and going, oh, this is too much. This is more than I am willing to take. And born out of that essentially was a couple of different movements. There were some brand new branch-off denominations, such as the PCA, Presbyterian Church in America, and some others. And independent Baptists kind of left the Southern Baptists because they felt that was getting too liberal. And there was the fundamentalist movement, essentially, that in many ways we are a part of that heritage. So we don't refer to ourselves as fundamentalists, but our spiritual forebears really fought those battles against what originally, I believe, was called modernism, but eventually became liberalism. So this was happening at the days of the Protestant Reformation. The Protestant Reformers said, this is more than we are willing to take, and many, many faithful Christians were unwilling to put up with this, and therefore the Reformers, those who led the charge, had a following quite easily. Did you have a comment, Jim? I thought I... We'll save that for another time. Is that okay? There were several tracks along these lines. So there is the corruption of the church and people becoming dissatisfied with that. But then there was this sense of people wanting to return to the source of Christianity. So if the church itself feels corrupted, if it feels hypocritical and false, then they say, well, what is Christianity? If what we grew up with is not the real deal, then what is Christianity? How are we going to find out what Christianity is? And scholars all over Europe began to study the Bible. Bingo, right? Okay, and they began to study the early church fathers. So if you were to read Calvin or Luther, you would watch them again and again and again refer to Augustine and many others, okay? You would see them doing that again and again and again, referring back to these early church fathers. So one of the things that's kind of feeding into this is the fall of Constantinople. So Constantinople falls in 1493, and Europe is flooded with scholars who have to kind of flee, and they have various views. They have different views from the Catholics. So you're, essentially what you're having is Eastern Orthodox scholars coming into Europe and voicing their disagreement with the Western Church, with Catholicism. Some of them are kind of saying, wait a minute, we were allowed to marry, right? The priests in the Orthodox Church are allowed to marry. You guys aren't allowed to marry. What's going on here? So you have these various disagreements. And also with them, they bring books. So they bring manuscripts, some of them quite ancient, of the New Testament, of the Old Testament. They have other books, copies of some of the early church fathers. So these things are beginning to kind of, it's like seeds in the soil of the spiritual life of Europe. And also, scholars at this point are able to take these manuscripts and compare. And essentially, what we call these manuscript families. So you have some Western manuscript families, and you have some Eastern manuscript families, and they have technical names and other things. But nevertheless, they're able to compare. There's like cross-pollination between these families. So you might imagine in Europe, within the Catholic Church, there's copy after copy after copy after copy after copy made, and they really don't cross-pollinate with the Eastern Orthodox Church, and they have manuscripts, and there's copy after copy after copy after copy made over there. And you have occasional mistakes in the copying process. You have intentional footnotes made. There's some of those footnotes are actually kind of funny. They don't exactly swear, but they call each other idiots. And they'll say, you know, some knucklehead made a change in verse so-and-so, and it really should be this. And they would do that, and now they can compare. They can compare everything. They compare the footnotes. They can compare the final products, and they're beginning to see that there are some issues with the Latin Vulgate. So everybody that can read, every priest, every monk is supposed to be able to read Latin. Now some of them couldn't; they were lazy and didn't study. But they were supposed to be able to read Latin. And so they're looking at these Greek manuscripts now. Some European scholars are becoming more and more interested and more capable at reading Greek instead of just Latin. And they're going, whoa, there's an issue here. There's a problem with some of the ways that the Latin Vulgate has been copied and some of the ways that the Latin Vulgate has been translated from the Greek to the Latin. So, of course, the Greek church used Greek. They're closer to the original. And then it's been translated into Latin, and they're saying, we got some issues with this. Does anybody know the primary issue that helped spark the Protestant Reformation? Okay. No, the translational issue. So when Jerome translated the Vulgate, he used the word penance instead of repentance. And they built up this doctrine around penance that replaced the idea of heart and life repentance. You could say a certain number of prayers, you could give a certain amount of money, and that got you the forgiveness of your sins, as opposed to repenting in your heart and in your life. So that translational issue is part of what's going on here. So, I mean, it's a real deal as they're comparing this Greek to the Latin. And so they are kind of returning back to the source. They're returning back to the Bible, right? And they're returning back to the Greek and the Hebrew of the original languages. Yes. Yeah, I think that the word penance came first, and that the corrupt heart of people built up around it this doctrine of penance. But yes, yeah, there are definite issues going on there. That's at the root of that doctrine. That's a bad translation at that point. Yes. That's a good question. I don't know for sure. The only answer that I could really give to that would be that the Orthodox Church prides itself on holding to tradition that predates the Catholic Church. So, but as in practice, I don't know. That's correct. That is correct. Yeah, so the Reformation rocked Europe, but not so much the regions such as Russia and other areas there to the east. That didn't really take place in the Reformation didn't happen there. Yeah. So it probably is less changed, but I don't have any real firsthand information. The Worldwide Church of True Believers. Yeah, frequently I try to do that. I try to mention the medieval Roman Catholic Church or the European Catholic Church or the Roman Catholic Church, yes. I do frequently try, but not always. Yeah. All right, go ahead. Okay, so if you drive north, it's not on Broadway. There's a Macedonian Orthodox Church. Is that on Broadway? Okay, so yes, Serbian, Macedonian, Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, and that whole group we would refer to as Eastern Orthodoxy. So it's Eastern Europe as opposed to Western Europe. And that's sort of a big group that's a little bit amorphous, sort of like we refer to Protestantism. You know, so there's lots of Protestants, Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, Reformed, Lutheran, and some others. So it's kind of... But there is no big Protestant denomination that's in charge of it all. So that would be something similar. But that's who we're talking about, yes. So there is, in Northwest Indiana, a fairly robust Macedonian community. And, you know, Rod Blagojevich may not have come from Indiana. I don't necessarily think that he did. But he had a lot of loyalists in Northwest Indiana, even after he was convicted and sent to jail, because of that tie, that Macedonian tie. And that's where his heritage is from. Yeah. So that is who we're talking about. Any other comments or questions? Right. Yes. Yes. So you do want to be cautious about they've changed a lot. So their practices have changed a lot. Those core doctrines that sparked the Reformation have really not changed, other than they let their people read the Bible, which has made for a grassroots change among those people. Just like there can be some confusion with the label Catholic, and we should use Roman Catholic to make sure that we're being clear, because Catholic can mean universal. That is what it means. And we are a part of that. Right? All true believers are part of the universal church. There can be some confusion with the label of Orthodox. So we are, orthodoxy means doctrinal faithfulness. And the Orthodox Church uses that as their label because they are doctrinally faithful to the first seven ecumenical creeds of the church. Okay? They're faithful to those seven creeds that predate the great schism that divided the West and the Eastern Church. So that's the reason they use the term orthodoxy. However, we have known some missionaries that worked in Romania, and there would be orthodoxy there, and it was scary weird. Okay, so just like we would very much question the doctrines of the Roman Catholic Church, we would definitely question the practices of the Orthodox, the Eastern Orthodox denominations or churches or whatever you want to call them. They are not regularly, faithfully preaching a gospel of grace through faith. Okay? And let me just make one more addendum, and that is this. There is a movement among the heirs of fundamentalism. Okay, so we are the heirs of fundamentalism. We're the ones who said we aren't going to have any denomination at all because all denominations are evil. They all just go liberal eventually, right? Okay, that's that is where our church came from, right? That's why there is a non-denominational Bible church movement. And we have seen liberalism happen in various denominations. But we feel rather disconnected at times. We say, you know, we have a heritage that goes all the way back to Christ. And there was a period of time in the fundamentalist movement that nobody ever taught church history. Okay, we just sort of acted like it all began in the 1900s, you know, and finally there were some faithful Christians again. And so because of that feeling of disconnectedness, many in our movement have returned back and become Catholic. They have become Orthodox. They have, if things are... And some of them have become Presbyterians, which is a lot better than becoming, you know, Catholic or Orthodox. But how many of you guys know the name Francis Schaeffer? You know that name, Francis Schaeffer. He's, of course, long gone. He's passed away. But he was an early leader in the sort of resurgence of conservatism in the United States and in Europe. Well, his son, Frankie, or I think probably he refers to himself as Francis now, he became Eastern Orthodox and is quite liberal in his theology now and in his cultural approach to things. So there is kind of this movement back as well. We need to kind of move on. Any other comments or questions?
In the
I was referring to the Romanian Orthodox priests that my missionary friends were familiar with. And do you know how Catholic practice has kind of syncretized with or meshed with all kinds of weird indigenous religions? So in South America, the Catholics, it gets weird in South America. You know, the statues of Mary bleed. There's a name for that. I've forgotten what it's called, but I'll think of it in a minute, maybe. But it's kind of like a mixture of Christianity and voodoo, right? And there was kind of the same thing happening in the smaller towns that were very dominated by Eastern Orthodoxy there in Romania, where our missionary friends were ministering. And so there were just weird ritualistic kinds of things that have nothing to do with Christianity that were being performed and done, and, you know, to protect the village, to protect children. That's what I mean. Weird stuff. Almost a mixture of paganism and Christianity. Okay. Sure. The Russian Orthodox Church doesn't even need the government to help them shut down a Christian church, yes. Yeah. So I would say the simple answer would be demonic kinds of things being done. And of course, that's not the official stance of that church, but it's what happens on the ground when there's that kind of unfaithfulness. All right, let's go down to just the heading there, discontent among the masses. Just like economically for the average person, nothing is improving. Peasants especially are continuing to be exploited and increasingly exploited by landowners. So there's kind of an economic distrust. People are hungrier, and this adds fuel to the fire. The feudal system also is ending. So we've talked about how regional or national monarchs are rising in power. The, as it were, the federal governments are becoming more powerful, and the regional lords or feudal lords, the landholding nobility, their power is decreasing, and that makes life difficult for them, and then therefore they make life difficult for the peasants that are kind of under them. And also, national languages are becoming more and more dominant. So French, Spanish, German, English, and on, they're becoming the national glue that is holding these individual national states together. So Latin is less important to sort of hold Europe together, and its influence is waning. Then there are some scientific discoveries. So you've got people sailing around the globe, and or sailing to new continents, sailing around the Horn of Africa to get over to Asia, and consequently the flat earth theory is becoming debunked even in the popular mind. There are great advances made in medicine, mathematics, and physics, and people want to enjoy the benefits of these discoveries. They're pressing, they're pushing for newness and for recovery and for renewal, just on an economic front, on a spiritual front, on a scientific front, scholarly front, everything. Just things, they are a-changing. It's just a sea change. It is a paradigm shift. All of these things, that the labels that we use to talk about these kinds of changes. Changes were coming, with or without the Protestant Reformation. There also is a humanist reformers. There are those who wanted to have a logical, tolerant, moderate reformation of the Catholic Church from within. They wanted to return back to the Greek text of the New Testament. They wanted to study the early church fathers. They wanted to reform the Catholic Church from within. They wanted to change its practices. They wanted no more abuses by the priests. They wanted no more indulgences, all of these things. And they were called humanists. And what that doesn't mean that they elevated human nature, and humanism today means the deification of humanity and the humanity of God, or making God like a human. It's leveling out God and humanity. That's what it means today. What it meant to them was that they studied the humanities. They studied philosophy. They studied medicine. They studied Greek and Hebrew. They studied the early church fathers, and they wanted this reformation to come from an academic arena. And the most important one of these was Erasmus of Rotterdam. I want to say a little bit about him, and then there's kind of a wrapping up that I want to do, and I might have to save that wrap up for next week, but here we go. So Erasmus's father was a priest. Now, are priests supposed to be fathers in the Catholic Church? I mean, we disagree with this, but nevertheless, this is an interesting thing, right? Oh, really? Wow. Maybe there will. Maybe they will. His father was a priest. His mother was a physician's daughter. He studied classical literature. He ended up visiting England, and there a group of scholars got him involved in studying the Bible, of all things, and in reforming the church. He also, however, was highly influenced by Stoicism and Platonism. So he, you think of just even the popular understanding of Stoicism, he was into controlling the passions through reason. Study philosophy to control your passions. For these monks ought to be students instead of philanderers, right? That's what he's trying to do and trying to say here. He encouraged a fairly ascetic discipline, but not monasticism. He is not for, you know, really being severe on the body, but a fairly disciplined lifestyle. He felt that monasticism was part of the problem, because what people were doing was, if they wanted to really be spiritual, they left society, they stopped going to the local parish, they moved to the monastery, and they lived in a cloistered environment, protected, quote-unquote protected from temptation, and that removed the really serious people from society. And he's saying, no, if you want to be a Christian, live out your Christianity in the world, in real everyday life, is what he is saying. He becomes very influential. One of his big ideas is the Christian soldier. The Christian soldier lives a life of devotion and seriousness, commitment to God, in the midst of society. And they influence society. He talked about avoiding pagan vices, and when he referred to pagan vices, he was referring to the Pope and the way the Pope lived, and referring to the priests and the way that they lived. He is redefining paganism as the vices of the official church. He was very influential academically, calling for an internal reformation, a peaceful reformation of the church. He had people, royalty and nobility, who would read his works, and also those who studied him became influential secretaries in the courts throughout Europe. So he holds a lot of influence through those who were kind of his disciples, so to speak. It seemed as if this internal peaceful reformation that Erasmus wanted to come was about to begin. But God saw fit to bring something else when the Protestant Reformation came and really broke out. Really a fire was started before this more peaceful reformation could happen from within. So I think we'll probably pause there and see if there are any comments or questions, and then I might have a bit of a wrap-up. We'll see. Nothing? So corrupt. Yes. Yeah. It did. I think that God in his sovereignty prevented what Erasmus wanted by bringing in what God wanted through Luther and Calvin and others. Now, there was a counter-reformation. So there were, just like there are some changes, like you mentioned, Brad, in the Catholic Church today, there were some changes. They did try to clean up their act and clean up the abuses. Now, I want to just make a brief comment. This is not in the notes, about Erasmus. How many of you guys have heard the term textus receptus? The textus receptus. The textus receptus was the standard Greek New Testament until modern times. Okay? And it was from many people who would consider themselves to be King James only, refer to the textus receptus. The textus receptus was created by Erasmus. So Erasmus gathered some manuscripts of the New Testament. However, it was relatively limited. He didn't have as many as we have today, and he didn't have even as many as they had then. They were all from one manuscript family, so I mentioned this earlier. There was finally some cross-pollination, so there were some from the East and some from the West. Well, there's really a total of four manuscript families, and he only had one. It was very limited, but he did what he should do. He obviously did what he should do, and that was to produce an edition of the Greek New Testament so that scholars could study it. However, those in our own generation who object to modern translations and believe that the King James is not only to be preferred but is the only good translation, the only right translation, have latched on to the Textus Receptus and said that is the best, it is the right, it is the only edition of the Greek New Testament from which we should be translating. And that's kind of what Don was talking about when he said this derogatory phrase used for fundamentalist, which is fundamentalism. Okay? It is kind of a duh type argument. And part of the reason for that is Erasmus himself. Erasmus was limited in the number of manuscripts that he had, and he didn't have a Greek manuscript to copy from for the last page of Revelation. Okay? He didn't have one. All right, just all of the. He had a bunch of manuscripts, seven or eight, and you know how paper gets worn, and old paper really gets worn, and pretty soon you're missing the index, and you're missing the title page, and you're missing Genesis chapter 1 and the last page of Revelation. He did not have the last page of Revelation, so he took the Latin Vulgate and retranslated it back into Greek for the closing of the New Testament. I am not dissing on the King James Version. I think it is a good translation, but it is not better than any of the others. And I am not dissing on Erasmus. I'm just saying he was limited, and we should not elevate his edition of the New Testament, the Greek New Testament, above others that have had opportunity to collect, you know, thousands more manuscripts than he had. So again, I'm not smashing the King James. It is a good translation, but it should not be elevated above others. It comes from, you know, the Textus Receptus and some others. So those guys who translated the King James, they had even more than Erasmus did. But we shouldn't sort of elevate some of these over others because they have had their limitations as well. So that's just a little factoid about Erasmus and an important part that he played in really working in Europe, because that Textus Receptus brought the Greek to people who had only been able to read, to scholars who had only been able to read Latin before, and they were able to study the Bible much more effectively through it. Any comments or questions? All right. Thanks. You're dismissed, and we will gather back for worship in a few moments.